Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity. And from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit DartmouthHitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. For most New Hampshire residents, Manchester's mills are just part of the scenery. Large, venerable, red brick structures hugging the Merrimack River, some in better shape than others. But the fascinating history of these buildings is receiving some renewed attention lately. This week, longtime Queen City historian Robert Perot is giving a series of Humanities Council lectures on the subject in several towns around the state. Also earlier this year, the national magazine Politico devoted a hefty, detailed article on how Manchester leveraged its industrial past to become, as Politico put it, a new millennium marvel. And then adding new scholarship to the topic is a recent book by another Manchester historian exploring what she calls a history of enterprise on the Merrimack River. Today in The Exchange, when the mills ruled Manchester and why it matters today, let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our two guests are Aurora Eaton. She's former executive director of the Manchester Historic Association, writer of a weekly New Hampshire history column in the Union Leader called Looking Back, and author of the book I just mentioned, The Amiskag Manufacturing Company, A History of Enterprise on the Merrimack River. And Aurora, congratulations on the book, and thank you for being here.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
Also with us, Robert Perot, an expert on Manchester history and New England Franco-American culture. He's a writer, public speaker, historical tour guide, and has published several books on this history, including a book of fiction, by the way. And Robert Perot, it's really nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Well, and I want to start with you, Robert. You know, many listeners may know a little about the Amiskag Manufacturing Company, how it was really the driving force in Manchester for a century. It seems unbelievable. But just to remind us how big and how important this textile enterprise was.
Well, it is said to have been the largest textile manufacturing company in the world. Now, there may be some people who would dispute that. My friend over here definitely does. But we really have no proof of that, actually. There were 30 buildings. They produced 50 miles of cloth per day.
600 miles per hour.
600
per hour?
Yeah, 600 miles of cloth per day in a 12-hour day. How do you measure what's the biggest? I don't know. Is it the number of buildings, the number of square feet? Is it the number of spindles? Is it the number of looms? Is it the miles of cloth produced? I don't really know, and we would have to do a real study of other mill towns. But they always, historians over the years have always said that Manchester, New Hampshire, had the largest textile manufacturing company in the world.
Well, I hope it's true, because every time we drive by, I say to my kids, do you know that Manchester?
So,
how do you measure it? But by a lot of those measures,
Robert,
it's ginormous.
Yeah.
Aurora, what do you think? How big, how important was it, especially at the heyday?
Well, in terms of, especially in New England, the textile manufacturers in New England, which was a huge industry for over 100 years here, it was the largest of the textile cities in New England. So people are probably more familiar with Lowell, because there's a national park in Lowell, but Manchester actually was the third of the manufacturing plants that was established by a group of people called the Boston Associates, who were wealthy Bostonian families. And it came after Lowell, a few years after Lowell, and it was actually much bigger than Lowell. And in Manchester, the Boston Associates had a lot more land that they could buy. They had over 15,000 acres of land. They had a lot more control over how the water power was developed and how the mill yard was developed. And it really was according to a plan that was developed in the late 1830s. So they, it was really a planned city and a very, very well-planned mill yard versus being done in pieces. And it was the largest and most successful, I think, of the seven or eight different mill cities that were developed by the same group of people.
So there were some particulars to New Hampshire and to mm-hmm. Manchester yeah. that allowed this to be
yes.
possibly the biggest.
If I could add something to that, you know, we call it the Amerskegg Manufacturing Company. So people always think of it as strictly manufacturing. It was really what Aurora was saying. It was a land and water power development company, which also, you know, it built the city of Manchester. It laid out the streets of Manchester. It bought up land on both sides of the river, and they decided how that land was going to be used. Where's the downtown going to be, and what buildings you could put in on a certain lot? What was going to be residential? Whether buildings were going to be made of brick or wood or whatever? They really took care of that entire. You know, agent. Our future agent of Amerskegg was actually a young engineer named Ezekiel Straw, who at 18 years old in 1838 planned out the city streets, which he superimposed, if you want, on the old roads that used to be what was the town of Derryfield at one time.
Sort of a cow town, right?
So, yeah.
So you're telling me that an 18-year-old basically made modern Manchester what it is
yeah.
today. You know, we were talking about just this whole idea of, as you mentioned, central planning, you know, not just here's how the company's going to work, but here's the streets and so forth. It sounds almost kind of Soviet, you know, this big,
well,
giant,
it was
one
way
person
before that,
deciding.
It was basically nothing was left to chance because the people who were doing this wanted to make sure that they attracted workers and that the workers had a place to live and that there was commerce that would support it. And they also wanted to make sure that there were city parks and there were places for schools and places for churches. And they worked out a lot of deals with the municipal the town and then the city after it became a city in 1846. So it was not a company town like we think of a company town in like a Midwestern company town where they had their own bank and all that. They did have their own bank very, very, very short period of time. But they set the wheels in motion, basically. And they had these land sales starting in 1838 where they would divide up the land on this big grid system and they would sell plots of land in certain sizes for certain types of either housing or commercial properties. And they would have deed restrictions and reverter rights, which still exist because the company that took over after Amerskegg left, which is called Amerskegg Industries, still exists and it still has reverter rights.
I don't know what that means for
reverter rights. Well, very, very simply, there are several churches in Manchester that are Protestant churches that were built on land donated by the Amerskegg Manufacturing Company because the company felt like, well, it'd be good to have churches here to make the community livable and
I see.
To keep the workers, you know, not going to the bars as much and all that stuff. So they gave land but in the original deeds for these properties, if the church is ever converted to housing or torn down, that the reverter rights means that the actual land goes back to the corporation, which the successor corporation has the rights to this land.
Well, it sounds like a one-company town to me, Robert.
It was in that sense.
I mean, if they're even deciding what happens with church buildings.
Yeah, and even in parks as well. That's something else if they donated a lot of land for parks. And for example, we have the Hillsborough County Courthouse, which is in one of the parks. It's Veterans Memorial Park, which used to be called Merrimack Common. They couldn't just build that like that. You'd have to go to Amerskegg Industries and get permission. So,
well, lots of detail and so many fun stories that I want to ask both of you about, but here's a bigger question before we get into all that. You know, beyond the fact that, you know, I'm interested, you guys are interested, people who live in Manchester may be interested. Aurora, to you first, why should other people be interested in this history of the Amerskegg Manufacturing Company that you've written about? You know, people in Keene or people in, you know, Nashua or wherever, why should this be of remote interest to them?
Well, the Amerskegg Manufacturing Company was a huge force in the whole development of New Hampshire industry and really affected the state politics as well as just the development of a particular city. So the Amerskegg had its fingers in many pies. And besides the manufacturing operation, the Amaskeg being the largest in New Hampshire for a long period of time, the railroads and the manufacturing industries in the state pretty much controlled state government. So if you're studying the history of the state and the political, which is a big issue this year, people are really into politics, you really need to look at the effect of having the manufacturing company having so much power, because not only did it have power over the land and the land that it sold, but it also had a lot of political power because some of its people that worked for the company were actually the state reps and the state senators, and there was a lot of influence there.
give us a little so detail. That's interesting, because people are really tuned into this idea of, you know, money and politics and power and how corporate interests shape policy.
For example, in New Hampshire, like in other places, there was a lot of reformist type of sentiment in the early 20th century against child labor, for example, the work week, trying to reduce the number of hours that workers worked. But there was always pushback from the manufacturing interests, as well as from the railroad interests, who had other reasons for doing this, to keep that from happening. So it really delayed a lot of things. But it turns out the reformists did have, you know, quite a bit of clout at different times in New Hampshire. So some of these laws were passed. 1911, the child labor law was passed, for example. But so it didn't have a lot of teeth to it. So in any case, there was always a yin and yang kind of things going back and forth. And to some extent, the agricultural interests were also in tune with this, because they didn't really want to have any limits on what they could do with their agricultural workers and with their family members, et cetera, in terms of child labor. So it wasn't just the manufacturing interests. It was a very interesting scene, I think, in the 1910s, 1920s, 1930s here in New Hampshire with the laws going back and forth. But I think in general why people should be interested is because Manchester, if you just drive through it, you can't miss it that
no,
we
can.
Are a former mill town, and it's absolutely flabbergasting, especially when you see it for the first time, to see this row of brick mill buildings that stretches for over a mile on the east side of the river, and with these big plants on the west side. So there's a curiosity there, and there's kind of an awe and a desire to know. And I think people really love history. Anybody who visits Manchester, that's one of the big things or comes here to live and gets a job here. People love to see these buildings. They love to see, and they want to know what happened. You know, why are these buildings here? What happened?
Yeah, and there's so much to talk about towards that end, you know, the rise and fall, so to speak. But I loved your answer on that, Aurora, and I'd like to hear from you too, Robert. I mean, again, for somebody listening far away from Manchester, gets to Manchester once a year, why is this of interest?
I would even go beyond Manchester and say that New England has several cities that were built by the Boston Associates, and Lowell being, you know, the number one, really, today, as far as they've got the National Park.
Right.
You know, I mean, we had the largest mill, but they have the park, and they're very lucky in that sense.
Now, why did they get the park, by the way?
Well, one of the things is I think they didn't fill in their canals the way we did. And plus, their canals go someplace. We had canals that were parallel to the river, and they just kind of just went down from the northern part of the mill yard to the southern part of the mill yard. Whereas in Lowell, if you look at the map of Lowell, it's more like a diamond, and you've got canals that go from one part of the river to the other. So the river is like kind of in diagonal. So you can actually go from one part of the city to the other and come out on the other side. And so they have nice canal rides there. And they didn't have a mill yard. They had several mill yards, smaller companies that were located in different parts along the river. So you can go from one mill yard to another in canals. And so
to the answer of why, you know, people outside of Manchester should be interested, you're saying this is part of New England's industrial history.
It really is. Yeah. Yeah. You can find mills in cities the size of Manchester, and you can also find in small places. I always think of Suncook and Greenville as two places that are really important. Now, that's in New Hampshire, but we have other places, Biddeford, Maine, and Lewiston, Maine, and Woonsocket, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts. And there are other towns that I probably can't name right now, smaller towns in those other states that would qualify as places that, are parallel to, say, Suncook and Greenville. So
I'd like to go back to Manchester, because I'm a big promoter of Manchester, but it's also unique amongst all of these towns as being the largest. and you know, larger than Lowell. But also, we have something. Lowell, the people of Lowell are very sad that they did, as they tore down nearly all of their workers' housing. So Manchester still has about 80% of the workers' housing, and it's actually the largest collection of 19th century workers' housing in North America. And so it is studied by architectural historians, et cetera, and it's really quite a picturesque little district, most of which is on a national heritage site and or it's a historic district. I'm sorry, it's a different kind of designation. So you can visually, there's a lot there in Manchester. And also, I think, like you had mentioned earlier about the article that was written recently in Politico about the city, is that these buildings are all being used. In fact, the Mill Yard right now is nearly 100% occupied and has been renovated, and it's really, you know, first class property in terms of having offices and museums and restaurants and everything. So it's a really huge success story. So people want to know, how did that happen? How did you get from being this mill town and going through all these changes and you're still thriving?
And some real struggles, you know,
some real struggles.
last century. I want to invite our listeners to join us again. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in the exchange, we are exploring the history of Manchester's mills, including a recent book out on the subject called The Amiskag Manufacturing Company, A History of Enterprise on the Merrimack River. The author joins us, Aurora Eaton. Also with us, Robert Perot, a longtime Manchester historian and New England Franco-American culture expert. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Your questions, comments, thoughts about Manchester's mill history and how it affected, as our guests are saying, the entire state, the entire region, are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Now, Aurora, actually, you mentioned the use of the mills today. Here's an email from Matt who says, I work in a mill at Dyne. That's a high-tech company. It gets a lot of attention and appreciation in New Hampshire. I work in a mill at Dyne, and Matt says, encourage anyone interested in Manchester's mills to visit the Sea Science Center's Lego model of the mill yard. I took my younger son to that last year, and he's a little older. I thought he'd be sort of, you know, jaded by Legos at this point, you know. And he said, wow, we spent an hour there. It was great. So yeah. I'd love your thoughts on who is in these buildings today.
Who is preserving
that history.
I'm glad to hear from somebody from Dyne, because my husband and I live in the workers' housing district, and in my little home office, I look out of my window and I see the Dyne sign, the back of it, but I see the Dyne sign every day. So who are in these buildings? Well, the University of New Hampshire has a wonderful building.
UNH Manchester.
And it's the old Pandora Mill building, which after the Amiskag Manufacturing Company left, it became a sweater manufacturer called Pandora. So it's called the Pandora Mill, and that is absolutely gorgeous. It was restored and renovated by Dean Kamen, who's restored several buildings. So you also have Dean Kamen's operation, which is DECA, which is doing, you know, high-tech development right there in the mill yard. Invention, the history of invention and enterprise is still continuing as it did throughout the history. And you also have some housing there now. Brady Sullivan has developed some high-class housing in the mill yard, which is something relatively new because that wasn't really zoned in until recent years. And you have a lot of small businesses, a lot of offices. You have, you know, dental practices. You have hairdressers. You have dance studios. There's just about everything you could ever want right there in the mill yard.
Let's not forget the restaurants.
The restaurants. There are restaurants, more and more restaurants, some really nice places to eat. And so it's my neighborhood, so I enjoy all the amenities in the mill yard. And like I said, it also is just beautiful to see the buildings. And there's a lot of wildlife, too, down the mill yard, because the river goes right through the mill yard. So it's very picturesque. There's a beautiful walk you can take along the river, river walk, we call it. And also you can see a lot of birds if you're into bird watching.
I've seen raptors seeking fish in the river.
All right. Eagles and everything else.
Well, and we'll definitely cover more of this issue of who's there today and how these have been redeveloped, and as we look at this broader rise and fall of the Manchester mills and the rise again, as you seem to be saying, Aurora. We'll also take your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us. Mm-hmm. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the Amiskeag Manufacturing Company and its legacy in Manchester and the broader New England region. We're looking at New Hampshire's mill history today in The Exchange, especially, of course, in Manchester. There's a recent book on the subject called The Amiskeag Manufacturing Company, A History of Enterprise on the Merrimack River, and so much more. Again, The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Join us with your questions and comments about this unique era in New Hampshire and Manchester history. 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Aurore Eaton, former executive director of the Manchester Historic Association, writer of a weekly New Hampshire history column for the Union Leader called Looking Back, and author of the book I mentioned, The Amiskeag Manufacturing Company. Also with us, Robert Perreault, an expert on Manchester history and New England Franco-American culture. Robert is a writer, public speaker, historical tour guide, and has published several books on this topic. One more time, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Aurore and Robert, let's go to John first in Wilmot. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. How are you today?
Good. Go ahead.
Good. I have a couple questions. You got to go over the workforce. Basically, you got to look at they initially did young girls, then they moved into the French Canadians, and then later on they moved into the Greek, and then the Scottish and Irishmen. You know, it was what they were making at the product at the plant. So they would produce ticking, which is, if you have ever been to an old hospital, was this white cotton with black lines on it. And they also produced gingham, and they also produced worsted wool. And that was the highest quality of all in the world, so to give you an idea.
Well, and thank you so much for the call, John. And let's definitely talk about, beyond the physical structures, let's absolutely talk about the people. And Robert, I'll turn to you first. Just sketch out for us, if you could, please, who came over time to work in these mills? It's pretty amazing.
Well, in the very early years, it was the local people. And then afterwards, as he said, the mill girls were coming from cities and towns around Manchester. And that was something – it was almost like sending your daughter off to college. You know, you wanted to make sure that she's going to go to the big city and work, and so she's going to be – she's got to be well taken care of. And so it was a very strict living in boarding houses where there were rules. You couldn't introduce tobacco or alcohol. You had to be in by a certain time. You couldn't have men there and whatever. And the girls even had to have a note from their pastor to say that they were church going and all that. That was in the 1840s and 50s for the most part. But even as early as the 1840s, there was the potato famine in Ireland, which brought in the first great wave of migrants to Manchester and to New England in general. These were the first unskilled workers, because they had also brought in from Great Britain expert dyers, weavers, spinners, largely from Great Britain, but also from Germany and from Sweden. And then, of course, after the Civil War, then that's when you had the Quebecois, the French Canadians, coming in large waves, and then eventually the Greeks and the Poles and others from Eastern Europe coming in.
Wow. So and just to put a year marker on it for folks, Amiskeag opens up, right, Aurora, in 1831.
It was incorporated in 1831. It did not actually start operating a mill until 1838, and that was a separate company that was leasing the water power.
Okay. So again, in terms of the workers.
But there were workers before that, because they needed people to dig the canals. And actually, there were some Irish workers who came as early as the 1830s to help dig the canals, and they lived in like mud huts along the side of the river. There was no housing there for them. So there was a lot of work going on in the 1830s, but it was infrastructure that was being built. So 1838 is when they really started with the mill girls and mill boys from the local farms, et cetera. So,
you know, it's so interesting that you say mill boys.
Yes.
I have heard so much more about the quote-unquote mill girls. How come?
I think it's – well, because Lowell, I think, put them on the map. They had their own newspaper, and they had a voice, and it was kind of an attractive thing to pay attention to. Also, it's more interesting, I think, to think about the girls. But there were plenty of young men who came. They got paid, by the way, for doing the same work as the girls, twice as much. And that was the reason they were really recruiting the girls more than the men, because they would work for half the pay and probably were considered to be, you know, less likely to get themselves in trouble and easier to dictate to. I'm not quite sure about that. But in any case, yeah.
Wow. Easier to manage and you can pay them half. Why not?
Well, actually, they would recruit whole families to come to event, you know, early on to come, and all the children would work in the mills. So it would be great, you know, to have a whole family of five or six kids and they would all work in the mills.
What do you think about that, Robert? Why do we hear so much more about the mill girls than the mill boys? Certainly there were people of both sexes working at these mills.
Perhaps because maybe it was more interesting. That's hard to say. I'm not really sure.
Well, speaking of the ethnicity, we got an email this morning from Richard in Hopkinton who says, as a German-American, it is of interest to me that a significant number of mill folks on the Merrimack were German. Richard says, my dad remembers German churches in Manchester. Turner Street in Manchester is named after the German Gymnastic Society's so-called Turner in German. Richard, thank you for the memory. And, you know, there is a lot of attention to the Franco-American history in Manchester. But, Robert, there were a lot of other ethnicities who came in and worked.
Oh, there were. In fact, in 1916, I read an article about a journalist who had come to study the mills, and he spent a week in 1916 and actually heard, he said, 28 different languages spoken in the Amiskeag mills in that year.
How many?
28 different languages.
And did they segregate people by ethnicity, Robert?
They tended to do that in order to have people working. It's easier to work together when you understand the language. And so I've heard stories of, you know, a French weave room or a Polish weave room or a French spinning room. Those were the larger groups. Of course, the Greeks tended to be in the card room. And also what they would do is if someone, a man, for example, had been there for a number of years and had become skilled, that person would be named a secondhand. And secondhand was like a small boss who was in between the workers and the overseers. And that was a way of controlling. In one way, they're promoting somebody from your own ethnic group, so isn't that great? You know, they could take pride in that. But at the same time, they could control the workers, because if they wanted certain work to be done, they're working too slowly or whatever, that guy can tell his people in their language, you know, the big boss really wants you to do a better job and whatever. And they would listen to him, whereas the big boss, who probably doesn't speak the language, you know, couldn't communicate that well. So, you know, there was some psychology to it, as well as ethnic pride.
I'd like to add just a little bit to that, and that with the people working together with the different languages, it was also sort of an unofficial apprenticeship system. For example, if somebody worked in the mills, they could bring in their nephew or their niece or whatever and kind of train them on the job in their language or whatever. And then that would be easier for the kid to get a job. So there was the mill owners in Manchester understood, the mill managers understood that this worked to their advantage. So they did not discourage people from speaking their own language or from sticking together. Whereas that was not the case in other mills in some of the other cities in New England.
Really?
Why
is that?
Because of, I think, a general paranoia that if they're speaking a language I don't understand, they must be talking about me or plotting against me or whatever. But in Manchester, there was kind of an more easygoing attitude towards that.
That's really interesting.
And also, I just want to mention one of the German people that came here to work was a man named Augustus Canis, Canis, C-A-N-I-S, and he came in the 1850s. And he was really instrumental in setting up the gingham weaving operations. He was a trained gingham weaver from Germany. And he worked with a lot of the Scottish weavers to kind of get that whole operation going. So the Germans did have a presence in the mill yard. They were a small minority, but they did really have an effect.
All right. So thank you, Richard, for the email about German Americans in the mills. You know, just picking up on what Aurora said, the different specialties that were done by different ethnic groups, the Scots, for example, and so forth. Robert, were different skill levels of workers treated differently? You know, were the specialty lace makers treated better than the sort of standard, you know? people who didn't have specific
definitely
skills.
If you were skilled, you were treated better, obviously better pay and more promotions and that sort of thing.
You get a better house to live in.
Well, even housing was shut off to many ethnic groups. I know of some families, Franco-Americans, who didn't get into worker housing until the 20th century because they were not in those positions. They would give that kind of a position to overseers and others. Now, we did have a few exceptions. I know the founding president of the Association Canado-Américaine, the ACA, named Théophile Biron. He became an overseer of weaving. In fact, he was the first one in the 19th century.
The first French-Canadian.
The first Franco-American.
To be put
yeah.
into a management position.
Right.
So were the French-Canadians sort of the lowest on the totem pole in that whole sort of mill political structure?
When they first came in, but then every new group that would come in obviously was lower on the totem pole. So the Polish and the Greeks and other Eastern Europeans came in afterwards. And so they would have, that would make the French rise. And of course the Irish, like as I said, after the potato famine had come in. So the Irish Catholics, and I got to say Irish Catholics, and the French Canadians were the ones who were able to get into worker housing later on, very late 19th century, early 20th century, whereas some of the other groups probably never made it in to the housing.
Let's take another call. And again, thanks for the email. You can email us at exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And from Webster, Brandon is on the line. Hi, Brandon. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. I'm looking at a picture that's from the National Child Labor Committee collection at Library of Congress. And it's documented as having been taken at noon. It looks like it's in front of one of the mill buildings on a broad promenade. And all the girls look very, very well dressed. I'm wondering what they would have done in the mill and what were they doing at noon? Are they on lunch break? It's an interesting picture from an interesting collection.
Well, Brandon, thank you so much for the call. And we should talk about, you know, the use of children and teenagers and young adults.
I'm sure you're looking at a Lewis Hine photo from 1909, May 1909, and I know exactly which photo you're looking at. One thing that was interesting, and this was true of the Franco-Americans as well as some of the other ethnic groups, is when you went into the mill, you would probably put on an apron, et cetera. But when people left the mills, when the girls, women, and men too, they tended to want to look really nice. So they would put on, you know, a nicer smock or a nice hat because it was a whole social atmosphere there too. It wasn't all, you know, working yourself to death. It was basically where you met people and where you had friends,
sure.
et cetera. So you're probably seeing the girls probably on their lunch break.
That's interesting. So good eye, Brendan, by the way, to notice that they look pretty nice to be working at a mill. They would change clothes.
They were proud of themselves, and they liked, you know, to get their new hat out and show people, et cetera. There's stories from the book Amaskeag. What's the full title of that book, Bob? 1978.
Amaskeag, Life and Work in an American Factory City.
And yeah. Bob had worked on that book doing oral histories, and people would talk about some of that.
Well, and what about the history of child labor, Aurore, how it sort of tracks, you know, how Manchester approached this issue, kind of tracks how we approached it nationally. You touched
it
on this earlier.
Kind of a matter-of-fact thing, because most of the people who came here, many of them from different countries had come from farming communities, et cetera, where children would just naturally work.
Sure.
And a lot of them had large families. And so it was just natural to send a child to work. I'm not saying it was good, but it certainly was natural. And even after 1911, when they passed the child labor law, where no child under 11 could work in the mill, and between 12 and 13 years old, you had to only work when the school was not in session. Those laws were broken all the time, you know, way into the early 20th century, including, you know, my grandmother was 9 years old and she lied about, you know, being much older than she was to be able to get into the mills, because it was kind of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge kind of thing of, you know, you tell us that she's 15, we'll believe you.
And, no birth certificate required.
Well, interesting. I gave a talk recently for the Franco-American Center, and somebody in the audience said that, did you hear at Sacred Heart Parish that the priest would actually produce false birth certificates? Now, I don't know if this I haven't confirmed this, but I would not be surprised. And there's a story in the book about somebody who had a birth certificate of an older sister who had passed away as a young child, and she was allowed to work, you know, and even took on the name of the sister and became known by her sister's name for the rest of her life while she was working. To meet the age requirement. So even after laws were passed, you pretty much could get away with it.
So your grandmother worked in the mills at age 9.
That's really not unusual.
Just having a hard time imagining a 9-year-old marching off to work with all that machinery. And yeah, I mean, it's dangerous.
They wouldn't necessarily work the hours that an adult would work, but they liked them in the spinning room where the yarn would break while it was being spun onto the spindles, and the little children could tie the knots. And so they weren't working constantly like the bobbin boys and bobbin girls. They would run around, put the bobbins on the machines, and then they go out in the hallway and play. So they had this sort of atmosphere. Plus, your mother was there, your uncle was there, you know, whatever.
So maybe your parents feel like at least they can keep an eye on
you. I'm not condoning child labor, but sure. When Lewis Hine came to take pictures in 1909, he went all over New England and took pictures of some pretty horrible situations with workers. But when he took pictures in Manchester, there was a couple of situations that were questionable that he snuck into the mills. He wasn't really allowed in officially. And you would not really want to see a 9-year-old child working in this room, but it was not unusual.
Well, and here's another question regarding labor. Thank you, by the way, Brendan, for that one. Ron from Manchester sent this email. To what degree were the mills dependent on slave labor for their raw materials, cotton, et cetera, from the American South? Robert, can you answer that question? And Ron, thank you for the email.
Obviously, with cotton, it all came from the South, and so they were quite dependent on slave labor. And that's something that is not necessarily thought of. We think about the cotton, yes, but you know, where does that come from? And it obviously is slaves who are picking the cotton. And of course, during the Civil War, that was cut off. We were cut off from the South, and so Amaskeag had to go into other industries. They had been producing steam fire engines for some time before that, steam locomotives actually, and they produced rifles as well for the Northern Army during the Civil War. And of course, there was wool. They were producing wool as well. So,
but interestingly, the Amaskeag kept producing cotton products during the Civil War because it had stockpiled, the companies in the mill yard had stockpiled over $2 million worth of cotton. They could sort of figure out what was going on. So they just kept operating. They also had some linen production. So
let's take another call. This is Frank in Manchester. Hi, Frank. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Did she mention the the previous question you guys just talked about? Is it in the book as far as the cotton coming from the South?
It's mentioned just very briefly. I did not get into that in any deep way. I just mentioned it briefly. It really was sort of outside of the scope of the book. This book is pretty much a quick history of the Amaskeag, but it's something certainly, if you're interested in that, the Manchester Historic Association has records going back to the beginning, and there's all sorts of contracts, and you can see actually where the cotton came from in the South. So if you wanted to track that kind of thing, some research could be done, and of course, you know, slave labor was it.
Well, it's interesting, too, you know, Robert, buying cotton from the South, slave labor, but then turning around and making guns for the North to go fight the South.
Yeah, quite a contradiction.
Well, thank you for that call, Frank. And we'll take more of your calls after a short break. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Coming up, we'll find out what happened to the mills after the turn of the century, their downfall, and their rise to where we see them today. All that's coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the Amaskeag Manufacturing Company and its legacy in Manchester today. We're talking about the mill history of New Hampshire's Queen City and how it relates to New England's industrial past. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Robert Perot is with us, an expert on Manchester history and New England Franco-American culture. Robert's a writer, public speaker, historical tour guide, and has published several books. Also with us, Aurora Eaton, former executive director of the Manchester Historic Association, writer of a weekly New Hampshire history column called Looking Back, and author of the book, The Amaskeag Manufacturing Company, A History of Enterprise on the Merrimack River. Again, 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us with your questions about Manchester's mill history, past and present. 1-800-892-6477. So we've talked a lot about the mills and how they came to be and how big they were, including that dispute over whether they were really the biggest or how you measure that. What do you think, Robert? What's the beginning of the end for this company?
The beginning of the end, I think, is southern competition. We had powerful rivers in the north, and while water power was in vogue, everything was fine. Then steam came in, and in the south, they began to have steam mills. And south, even though slavery was abolished, you still had cotton coming in from the south, and the people now were sharecroppers. And so they're able to produce cloth down there right where it's being grown, so they don't have to ship it up so up here north to be refined the way they did before. And so the south can produce cloth a lot cheaper than the north, and so the north had to do something in order to compete with the southern mills. And so they increased work hours and they decreased pay. That was one of the ways. And there were strikes here and there in New England. Now, Manchester was known as the strikeless city. And that's
really
because Amiskeag had developed by 1911. They developed even earlier, but in 1911, they had a big restructuring of the company, a paternalistic system that set up all kinds of programs to help the workers. They already had the housing and all that, but the Amiskeag Textile Club with its baseball team, they had a school for textiles. If somebody wanted to improve their skills, they could learn there. They had a home economics school as well for women to learn skills there. They had medical and dental services for the workers.
So if you turn against the company, you're turning against, you know,
right,
a lot of services that you benefit from.
It was to develop a loyalty to the company, but at the same time, if you develop that loyalty, it's a way to manipulate the people into being loyal. And so for many years, they were able to avoid labor unrest. And of course, the World War I came, and obviously the contracts, mill contracts, were increased at that time. But then after the war, things kind of went back to normal, if you want. Things went down, and that's what led to the big strike of 1922. This is where they announced on February 2nd, 1922, they said, as of February 13th, 1922, we're going to increase the work week from 48 hours to 54 hours, and we're going to give you a 10% reduction in rates.
Wow.
That's part, 20%, excuse me, which if you combine those two, the upping the hours but also lowering the pay, it came to a 10% pay cut.
So a big competition from the south, but that's sort of held off for a while, Aurora, because as Robert said, you know, World War I increases activity, but then things really start
exactly
to go down.
It. And a little bit of interesting factors here is that they knew this was happening by the late 19th century, that the southern competition. And it really wasn't as much competition. Eventually, the textiles produced in the south weren't that much cheaper than the ones in the north because there was a lot of expenses in setting up the southern mills. And they actually had to provide housing for the workers in many cases. But it was overproduction. There was just too much out there. And what happened after World War I, besides the fact that they could start importing fabrics again from Europe and there was more competition there, was that the people's tastes were changing. So the Amiskeag, its major project was gingham. It was the premier producer of gingham in the entire United States. And gingham is plaids and checks and fabrics like that, which are done on special looms with special dyes. People started, they didn't want to wear gingham dresses anymore.
Sure, fashion
changes. Or even
changes.
Gingham shirts. And rayon started becoming the big thing for dresses in the 1920s, and the southern mills could be set up immediately to do rayon. So the northern mills had antiquated equipment, and the workers were, you know, had higher rates of pay and all this kind of stuff. And there was overproduction. Gingham was starting to be dumped on the market by the 19 after, you know, the World War I. So you start seeing this sort of economic thing happening of just having too much. So the workers, what happened with the workers is they kept having work slowdowns. So you'd be told, well, you have to stay home for 2 weeks and no pay, and then you can come back.
So like a furlough.
And it started driving them crazy. And
sure.
So by 1922, when they did this thing that Bob talked about, if now you have to work, you know, 6 hours a week more and get paid 20% less I think it was about 9,000 workers or so were still working at the Amazigh at the time. They just said, most of them just said, we're on strike.
So did they join unions and
at
go on
point,
strike? Or what was the role of sort
at that
of
point, the United
unions?
Textile Workers did have its foot in the door. It had a few years before led a really small strike. So they were beginning to attract people to become members of the union. And some of the union activity, besides the fact that workers were generally in earlier years happy with the company, was also had to do with the ethnic groups involved, et cetera. For example, I know the Franco-Americans, it was kind of frowned upon to join these unions, et cetera. So there was a whole cultural element there. But people were pretty fed up by 1922.
Well, it is really interesting that you say that, Aurora. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I've read a couple of your books, Robert, and I have picked up that element that different ethnic groups felt differently about that organized labor element. And the Franco-Americans didn't warm to that idea. I was going to say didn't cotton to that idea, but that would be
in fact,
a bad pun.
We always hear about the traditional rivalry between the Irish and the French. Now, that went way back to the early years, but when you get to the strike, obviously the Irish they were fighters. They wanted to fight for their rights, and here were the Franco-Americans who were saying no, no, no. And even I interviewed people for the other, you know, the book Amiskeag, Life and Work in an American Factory City, and people who told me, oh, the priests would preach to us on Sunday telling us, you know, grin and bear it, offer it up to God, you know, don't fight, don't, you know, just this is the way things are, and don't, because you're going to lose your job or whatever, if, yeah, you know, so they were good little boys and girls. And
yeah. There were some who
some
did.
Yeah.
And it split up families.
And I did. I interviewed one family like that where this is 1974. I'm interviewing a family where they had not spoken to their relatives in 50 years because of the strike.
Wow.
They were on opposite sides of the strike.
The pro-strike and the anti-strike
yes.
sides of the family.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go back to our listeners. Lots of people want to jump into our conversation. Kim is joining us from Manchester. Hi, Kim. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
I remember as a child, I used to go to the Historic Society, and I remember reading that some of the mill buildings, when they were built shortly or during the time when Lincoln was shot. And it's my understanding that there are black bricks that commemorate that because they were in the process of building. And I'm wondering if I recall that right or not.
Wow, Kim, I hadn't heard that. Robert, do you know?
Oh, yes. It's a legend. I remember one time with my uncle going by. This was rows of corporation housing going down from Elm Street on West Bridge Street. And they happened to have a black row of bricks. And my uncle said, did you know that those were built when Lincoln was assassinated? And so this is to commemorate it. It is purely legend.
Too bad.
I know.
It
you
never
know, these,
dies.
These stories just never die. If you go to the Mark Twain House in Hartford, you will find orange and black rows of bricks. It's just an architectural feature. And I'll tell you, those were built in 1881. So Lincoln was assassinated in 1865. Now, it's coincidence that James A. Garfield was assassinated in 1881. So maybe that's how it started, but it's purely ornamental.
Sorry about that, Kim. Thank you for calling
Hate
in.
Hate to ruin your day there, Kim, but that's life.
And let's go to Laconia, where Michael is on the line. Hi, Michael. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Good morning. 3 points. One, I'm not sure that there's any other company in American history that has lasted from the dawn of the Industrial Revolution to the present day. which I think makes Amoskeg unique. Two, all the power for Amoskeg came from Lake Winnipesaukee. So the company really controlled the water in the southern half of the state, and the lake levels, they flooded Paugus Bay, and the farmers blew up the dam, tried to blow up the dam. And the third point is that they didn't just make textiles. They made fire engines. They made steam locomotives. They made the turret, the bearing that turned the turret on the monitor, the ship in the Civil War. They had an enormous machine operation there as well. It wasn't just textiles.
You know, Michael, that's such an important point, and I'm glad you raised it. They did make a ton of stuff there beyond textiles. We just have about 5 minutes left, so I won't address all your points, Michael, but to the middle point, I think it's really interesting and important, Aurore, to what we were talking about earlier, why should the rest of New Hampshire care about Manchester's mill history? He's right. The whole water power issue
it wasn't just
affected
a
lot of people.
It wasn't just for the Amoskeg Manufacturing Company. It was the Boston Associates who bought up the mill rights and the various canals, et cetera, along the Merrimack River. And they also got all the water power rights all the way up to Lake Winnipesaukee because they wanted to control the entire Merrimack River because it wasn't just Manchester. They also had operations in Hooksett. They had, which was a small operation, part of the offshoot of Amoskeg Manufacturing Company. They also had Lowell, they had Haverhill, Massachusetts, and had other places downstream. So their whole thing was to control all of this, which, you know, was absolutely amazing. And I just want to mention briefly what he said at the beginning about the companies. The company does not exist anymore in any form whatsoever. It ceased to exist as a manufacturing company in 1936. The company that exists now, the Amoskeg Industries, bought out the assets of the Amoskeg Manufacturing Company in 1936, and it's a locally owned company in Manchester. I know people on the board, and they own all these reverter rights. So thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you very much. And it's very interesting to hear about the farmers not necessarily loving the way that Amoskeg decided to manage the water. So thank you for that call. Here's an email from Andrew in Peterborough, kind of bringing us up to the present. He says, it would seem the volume of vehicular traffic requiring parking lots is negatively impacting Manchester and the historic mills. Andrew asks, why hasn't Manchester done what Lowell has done and restore a historic light rail trolley system? I know they've been talking about this a lot. Either of you want to jump in on that?
Well, Dean Kamen is a big proponent of that.
I've read that. Yeah.
I would love to see that. Absolutely. So why? Good question.
I think politicians just don't want it. I mean, not all politicians, but some don't want it, and they vote against it. Every time, it seems as if every time this is brought up, there's always a study in the thousands of dollars to study it. And I keep thinking, you've studied it and studied it and studied it. You know, we did bring, this is not light rail, but we did bring, for in 1980, we had rail service to Manchester very briefly. It didn't last very long. I remember my sister used to go down to Boston to see her boyfriend, and she would take the train.
As late as 1980?
1980, yeah. The trains went, passenger service went out in 1968. Actually, the railroad station had been torn down in 62. But in 1980, it was just an experiment to see if it would work. It didn't last very long.
What about the idea of just light rail within Manchester proper, so that people wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't have all these parking issues and traffic issues that Andrew mentions by the mill yard?
I don't think it's ever been considered seriously, but like I mentioned, the inventor, Dean Kamen, who owns several buildings in the mill yard, brings it up on occasion.
Well, we often hear that millennials don't want to drive and
true.
You know, they want to be.
And they're actually living in the mill yard
right.
now, so they just walk right to work.
Well, here's another email from Christopher in Manchester, again, talking about contemporary issues in this area. Christopher says, I think the most exciting development in the mill yard in the last few years is the long-awaited component of residential units. Businesses and restaurants have been thriving for the last few decades, but things kind of shut down after 5 p.m. and on weekends along Commercial Street. Folks actually living there give it even more life and character. Christopher says a true renaissance. Here's a question, though, following up on Christopher's email. Robert, what have some of the challenges been towards creating, especially residential properties, out of these old mill buildings? I mean, sometimes you have contamination issues, asbestos or lead or whatever. I mean, these are old buildings from another era when we had less exacting environmental standards and human health standards.
Actually, bringing residential, other than the corporation housing, which a lot of it is still residential, but some of it is commercial as well and professional. As far as mill buildings is concerned, this has been talked about for years, and the city government just always resisted. It's only in recent years that they've had certain mill buildings. Over on the west side, the big one on the one called Mill West on McGregor Street has apartments, and over on Commercial Street there are apartments now. But this is all very, very, very recent. But converting them is not really that easy. I mean, when you're in there, you see very high ceilings, and it's not personally. I don't think it's cozy, you know what I mean? It's, you know, you feel like you're in a mill, you know, unless.
I think they're fabulous. I've been in a couple of them. But there have been some issues recently in the news that have had to do with removal of asbestos and hazardous waste and all that kind of stuff. So I think it's certainly, obviously has been done very successfully, but there are some challenges, obviously.
Yeah, Brady Sullivan Properties, one of New Hampshire's largest real estate developers, has come under investigation for some of its construction practices in the mill yard. And EPA has concerns about hazardous lead dust and so forth. So it's a nice idea, but hard to make happen.
My husband
sometimes.
And I live in a mill housing building, and we have lead paint. So, you know, it's everywhere. So,
all right. So I hate to do this to people, but in 30 seconds or less, is there one thing, Robert, that you just want to make sure folks absolutely know?
Yes, that the Amiskeag manufacturing company we said was perhaps the largest company. Well, that Lego display is also the largest Lego display of that size Lego in North America. Don't forget
permanent.
That.
Permanent display. Permanent. And also, please visit the Mill Yard Museum, which is in the same building as the Lego display, because that has all of this wonderful mill history right there for you.
Well, it's been really fun to talk to both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank
Aurora,
you.
Thank you
You're
very
welcome.
Much for being here.
You're
Robert,
welcome. You're welcome.
You
Thank
as
you
well.
For having me.
Robert Perreault, an expert on Manchester history. He's a public speaker, tour guide, published several books. Aurora Eaton's new book on this is called The Amiskeag Manufacturing Company, A History of Enterprise on the Merrimack River. This is The Exchange on NHPR.